I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. A year and a half after being charged with drugging and sexually assaulting a woman named Andrea Constan, in 2004 at his home in suburban Philadelphia, the trial of Bill Cosby is underway. Jury selection began in Pittsburgh this week, and next week the trial moves to Montgomery County, just outside of Philadelphia. While dozens of women have claimed that Cosby harassed and or sexually assaulted them, this is the first time he has been criminally charged. The case has gotten national attention, and here in Philadelphia, it has particular resonance because of his ties to the city. We'll talk about Cosby's rise and fall with WHYY's Annette John Hall, the host of a podcast that debuts today, Cosby Unraveled. That's a little bit later in the show. Back in October 2014, comedian Hannibal Buress made critical comments about Cosby while performing at the Trocadero in Philadelphia that went viral, saying he resented being told how to behave by a man who was a rapist.
Bill Cosby has the smuggest old black man persona that I hate. Just gets on TV. Pull your pants up, black people. I was on TV in the 80s. I can talk down to you because I had a successful sitcom. Yeah, it was rape women, Bill Cosby, so kind of brings it down a couple notches. I don't curse on stage. But yeah, you're a rapist, so I can take you saying lots of on Bill Cosby himself if you weren't a rapist.
That was Hannibal Buress. We asked Graham Boley to join us, a New York Times reporter. He's been covering the charges and allegations against Bill Cosby. And Graham Boley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. That's really rough stuff, I have to say, coming from Hannibal Buress. How much do you think that comedy routine that did go viral, how much do you think this helped to open this case?
I think it was crucial. It started the floodgates. There had been many women who had made complaints in the past but had never really been heard or had never really forcefully come forward. Once that routine had aired and gained widespread publicity, many other women came forward. They were emboldened and they spoke out. So I think that was a crucial part of it right at the beginning.
What are the specific charges that Cosby faces?
Aggravated indecent assault, drugging and assaulting Andrea Constant. You know, it's important to remember that although there have been many, many, you know, more than 40 women who have made similar allegations, he's going to be tried just on one case, Andrea Constant's case. And the allegations there are that he drugged her and sexually assaulted her at his home in early 2004.
Now, what makes this even more complicated and perhaps even controversial is this really goes back to a civil suit that Andrea Constan charged Bill Cosby with, essentially what he's being charged with today, but in a civil suit. Take us back to, that was what, 2005?
That's right. So the alleged assault happened in 2004. Andrea Constant was employed at Temple University. The incident happens. She leaves Temple and returns home to Canada. But about a year after that incident, she goes to police for the first time and reports what she said was this crime. The district attorney, the prosecutors in Montgomery County, investigated for about 2.5 weeks. But the DA at the time concluded that there was not enough credible evidence to bring this case before a jury, so he didn't bring charges. But within weeks, Andrea Constant and her lawyers brought a civil suit in Philadelphia, about March 2005,
right.
In which she brought these claims to Mr. Cosby in a civil case, in which Mr. Cosby and Ms. Constant testified, and that suit was settled in 2006 for an undisclosed financial sum and a non-disclosure agreement between the two parties. And so that seemed to have been the end of it. That seemed to have put it, the case sort of to rest, as it were, only for it to reemerge in 2015, of course.
Well, and what's you were able and others were able to get their hands on this testimony, coming from Bill Cosby about giving Constand some tabs or about 1.5 tabs of Benadryl. What did you learn, or what did we learn from some of that testimony?
The testimony, I mean, it was remarkable. 4 days of testimony that Mr. Cosby gave, which, you know, probably the most important event was when Judge Rubino in Philadelphia decided to unseal portions of that testimony. And once he'd done that, we realized this testimony existed. And so we went to get it, and we got it. And we could see Mr. Cosby, in his own words, admitting no crime. All the sexual activity was completely consensual. That's very important to remember. But kind of displaying this sort of cavalier attitude to women and numerous extramarital affairs, and at one point saying that he gave quaaludes to he obtained quaaludes to give to women for sex. So this changed the perception of Mr. Cosby in a very important way, I think. And that deposition, along with the many other complaints by many other women that had come forward, with the two main reasons, I think, that prosecutors in Montgomery County decided to revisit the case, reopen it, and investigate. And that ended in December 2015 with the arrest of Mr. Cosby.
And it seemed as if his testimony, reading what you wrote and others have written, was pretty graphic.
Yeah, it was very graphic. He spoke at length about, and he was questioned at length about, not only the Andrew Constant relationship, and, you know, we learned so much about it from that testimony over the several months, you know, when they knew each other in Philadelphia, but his relationship with many other women. And we saw the way he used, I think I wrote at the time, sort of the way he used his fame and his money to impress women and in his pursuit of affairs, you know, one after the other. It was very graphic.
I'm assuming there was testimony from Andrea Constand. What did she say?
There was, but we don't know.
We don't know.
Because we only obtained Mr. Cosby's. All of this was not sealed, but sort of there was this acknowledgement, a non-disclosure agreement, and that's never been released. We've never seen that. But no doubt Mr. Cosby's lawyers have it. Certainly the prosecution has it, and we'll perhaps learn more through the trial. That side of the story will come out in the trial.
And her charges, her allegations against him was that he drugged her, sexually assaulted her, obviously against her will. Is that the kind of nub of what she's saying?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we know a lot from the police statements that he and she gave at the time. She gave three, and he gave one, and they're public. We have them. They've already been released in court documents. So we can see very much the Constant case, the kind of the narrative, and the way that the two describe it very differently. Mr. Cosby describes it as a kind of a blossoming romantic relationship, a number of encounters at his home, whereas she describes it as a very businesslike way in which she does say that he, you know, comes on to her at least twice, and she rebuffs him. And then on the third occasion, when she goes back to his home, he assaults her, she says. But it's a very different idea of how it was happening.
And it should be said there was about a year's time between this incident and then when Andrea Constand went to the police.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken to experts, and experts who look at this will say, you know, there are important questions that she will have to answer in this case. One, why did she take such a while to go to police? And, you know, sexual trauma experts say it does take a while for people to process this if indeed she was sexually assaulted. And there were certain inconsistencies in what she told the police investigators in the different reports, but experts say that's also understandable. There's the case that she did have this friendship with him, and even though on two occasions he, you know, came onto her, tried to touch her waist, her inner thigh, tried to unbutton her trousers, her pants, she still went back to his home. And already Mr. Cosby's lawyers in the pretrial hearings have shown the kind of aggressive way they're going to pursue those questions. They're going to make much of those points.
How many women, you said 40, I've seen 60. How many women have made allegations against Bill Cosby?
We said about more than 40 because these, you know, of actual drugging and sexual assault. We ruled out, you know, there were a few other women who said, you know, he inappropriately touched us or kissed us inappropriately in a wrong moment. So we didn't include those. We went with a conservative number, which is still quite a staggering number of 40 women. And we've spoken to many of them. And, you know, they have different stories. The prosecution, of course, chose 13 of all those women who they put forward to be included in the trial because their stories bore such a close pattern to Miss Constance, very close sort of idea of mentoring, friendship in an early stage, meeting parents perhaps, which is what happened with Miss Constance, tickets to shows, which is what happened with Miss Constance, and then eventually, you know, closer and closer relationship ending with alleged drugging and alleged assault. Mm. So the prosecution chose 13. In the end, the judge allowed one woman who we... who is going to be testifying as a witness at the trial.
This is a woman who, I don't know if this is her actual name, but goes by the name Casey, worked for Cosby's personal assistant. She also alleges he drugged and sexually assaulted her. This was back in 1996 at a hotel. She was about 35 years old. Is there anything else we know about Casey?
We know very little. We know that... she didn't come out when it happened. She didn't complain, you know, bring a complaint when it happened. And she has a reason for that. You know, coming to terms with that with this assault was hard, she said. We know that she did then come forward, I think, in 2015 and made her complaint and goes by the name of Casey. We know also that she has worked and testified in California to extend the statute of limitations there for sexual assault. So she's sort of come into the line, into the spotlight a little bit there, but she'll emerge from, you know, the many women, you know, very clearly in Norristown during the trial when she testifies as this prior bad acts witness.
We're almost up at a break. It should be said that Bill Cosby says he will not testify. Is Andrea Constance, is she going to testify at this trial?
She is, yeah.
She is.
And we got, she will, I think, I'm pretty sure. And at the jury selection in Pittsburgh, the judge read out a long list of names, and this is the only time we'll ever see this or hear this, of other witnesses. So there were some interesting names in there who are probably going to be witnesses, or it certainly will be mentioned as important references during the trial.
Graham, can you stay with us? I know you are monitoring the jury selection out there in Pittsburgh. Can you stay with us for a couple of more minutes?
Sure.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Graham Boley. He's a New York Times reporter. He's been covering the charges, the case against Bill Cosby. The jury selection is underway in Pittsburgh. Interestingly, the trial will take place just outside of Philadelphia. I posted something on our Facebook page. Could you serve on this jury? Do you have an open mind about this case? Give us a call. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone talking with Graham Boley. He's been covering the timeline of allegations against Bill Cosby. We'll also be talking about what to expect at the trial. And again, to join our conversation, particularly interested if you have an open mind about this case, call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play an excerpt from a Michael Smirkanish interview with Bill Cosby that aired last week. The clip actually opens with Cosby's daughter, Ensa, making a statement, and then Smirkanish talks to Bill Cosby about his response.
I strongly believe my father is innocent of the crimes alleged against him, and I believe that racism has played a big role in all aspects of this scandal.
Do you agree with that?
Could be. Could be. I can't say anything. But there are certain things that I look at and I apply to the situation, and there are so many tentacles, so many different nefarious is a great word, and I just truly believe that some of it may very well be that.
Graham, it's interesting that the jury is being selected from the Pittsburgh area, not the Philadelphia area, thinking that pretrial publicity could hurt Bill Cosby. And yet he's a national, if not an international figure. And clearly there's both a PR campaign for him, and there's been a probably PR campaign against him, and certainly a lot of publicity. What do we know about the jury so far?
They've just started the third day of jury selection. They've been through the first 100, pool of 100. They're starting on the second pool of 100, and Judge O'Neill is addressing them now in Pittsburgh, in the Allegheny County Courthouse. And so far, in the first 2 days, they've selected 11 and have, so one more for the main jury to go, and then six alternates. And of the 11, so far we have 10 white people and one black person, and a seven man or four women.
Seven men and how many women?
Four.
And four women. You also wrote that the summons went out to something to more than 3,000 people, I guess, wanting this expanded pool of jurors from whom to choose.
Right, yeah. And court officials said, you know, a typical number would have been about 150. So this was far above average. And the reasons for this were twofold, it seemed. One, because of this problem that people everywhere, it seems, have heard of the Cosby case. And two, the difficulty of traveling 300 miles east across the state to from Pittsburgh to the Philadelphia area for the trial. And so they thought that this would rule out a lot of people pretty quickly. And it was very evident. It was very striking sitting in the courtroom on day one, 100 jurors in the room, and the judge asked people to put up their hands if they had heard of the case. And I think it was about 86 people, more than 80, put up their hands straight away. And then he asked, you know, who's formed an opinion as to the innocence or guilt in this case. And it was about a third of people put up their hands. So that set the tone for the selection. And then when they went into individual individual questioning, it was this repeated pattern, this theme of, you know, have you heard the case? Have you formed an opinion? And it ruled many people out.
Let me read a comment from Kirsten, who says, and this was an answer to the question that I posted on Facebook, could you have an open mind? She says, I guess I wouldn't have an open mind in that sense, because there have been so many women who have come forward. There's no doubt in my mind. Why would they subject themselves to the difficulty of coming forward, barring some alien plot? I just don't see what sort of conspiracy there could be that would cause so many women to say something that wasn't absolutely true. Graham, you have interviewed a number of these women who have made allegations about Bill Cosby. First of all, how many have you talked to?
Well, with my colleague, Sydney Ember, who I work with here, we've spoken to dozens, I'd say. I've spoken to several, some more than others. There was an initial, after the Annabelle Buress clip that you played, you know, there was many women came out then, and you know, it was very interesting to talk to them. There then came this, first of all, civil suits, and then the criminal case, and then it became very hard to talk to many women, especially on the record, but still several, you know, still aren't involved in those cases and have been talking to us, and we quote them in our stories.
Was it hard to get them to tell their story?
It was very painful. And we had to gain their confidence. And, you know, we and other newspapers have covered this, and I think some have done it very well, and gain the confidence and tell their stories accurately. We were very keen and very eager to tell their story, but to draw no conclusion, of course, of guilt or innocence. Mr. Cosby's innocent. And it's very important to remember in this case that he's being tried on only one case,
right?
Andrea Constance. And on the facts of that case. But it was a privilege to talk to many of these people. I don't know if they felt the same way.
Yes, I get it.
But it was very interesting. I see this story sort of splitting into two. The first was talking to the women, telling their story, understanding their story, you know, understanding it for credibility purposes, understanding what it said about Mr. Cosby, whether what they were telling was true. And it was piecing together these lives that were lived sometimes decades ago. These periods happened in the 60s, 70s, 80s. I remember talking to one person it all happened in Las Vegas around a hotel, and understanding her life and her life since then and how it had played out. And because of what had happened to her, you know, the effect that this attack from Mr. Cosby, the alleged attack, had had on her. And it was very moving to hear all that and to understand that. The second half of the story, it moved into the courtroom. And then it became this very complicated legal chess game between Mr. Cosby's lawyers on the one hand and the prosecutors in Montgomery County on the other, as Mr. Cosby first fought to keep the trial from going ahead at all, tried to have the charges thrown out. And then, secondly, fought very hard to form the kind of evidence, the shape of the evidence that will be submitted at trial.
I mean, there are always those memory questions when something has happened decades ago, and clearly that could be a factor. But did you see patterns of stories, and did the other women know about, I mean, how much publicity had there been so that they might have known what the allegations or what some of those patterns were?
That's a point that Mr. Cosby's lawyers have made when they pushed back very aggressively against the 13 being admitted at the trial. They said that some of these were obviously copying others. I don't think that was the case. I mean, maybe in some cases, I'm not sure. But, you know, the women I spoke to, tremendous pain. You know, their stories were all very different, different locations, different times, the facts, and some, you know, you could understand why some people might want to come forward, but to also put yourself in the spotlight in such a painful way would make me think twice. And also speaking to women, at least one woman who hadn't come forward, who hasn't come forward, and understanding, you know, and seeing things there and hearing things which made me, you know, believe what other people were telling me.
Have you ever talked to Mr. Cosby himself?
I haven't, no.
Have you asked to?
We have. I have, yes. And he hasn't spoken. He's been very closely guarded by his publicist and his lawyers. We tried. I mean, we have spoken to his lawyers over the year and a half or 2 years, 2.5 years, I guess. There was a very aggressive push, phase one, from his lawyers and against the media and against the women, and that resulted in him being sued by some of the women for libel. And then he went very quiet. But then recently, as you noted in the report, there's been this an attempt to, as his lawyer put it, change the optics. So sort of an outreach to sort of influence public opinion, I guess. And we've heard from his daughters. We've heard from Mr. Cosby himself in print and in the radio interview. And, you know, describing his life and his achievements, not addressing the charges, although talking about, as you pointed out, the issue of racism.
Right.
So he has been more out there now, but we haven't been able to ask him questions.
And that's Graham Boley, New York Times reporter. He covers culture and has been covering the charges against Bill Cosby. The trial is underway. Jury selection taking place, sounds like near conclusion, in Pittsburgh this week. And the trial set to get underway just outside of Philadelphia in Norristown in Montgomery County. To join our conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Bunch of comments coming in. Radio Times at whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Bruce, he says, I hear people joke about Bill Cosby and I hear them express disgust. I never hear my primary emotion, sorrow. Celebrity news is always the last category I find interesting. Yet for decades, this man was America's father. I feel betrayed to a depth that surprises me. It runs as deep as my gratitude does to these brave women who've removed our blinders. And, I mean, we're going to be talking, Graham, in more detail about Philadelphia, of course, the home to Bill Cosby in many ways. But there is this kind of range of emotions, I think, that so many people have based on Cosby the man, Cosby the actor, Cosby the commenter on social mores.
Right, yeah, and you're going to have to excuse me in a minute because I have to go to, I'm really sorry, to report on the decision because it could come soon. But yeah,
okay.
I agree. I think most people that we speak to feel that sense of betrayal, you know, that they love Bill Cosby and now they feel betrayed by him.
Well, Graham Bolley, thank you so much for staying with us, joining us this morning on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we have been talking about the long road to Bill Cosby's trial that began this week with jury selection. I am sure you know that Cosby grew up in Philadelphia. In fact, in the Richard Allen Housing Project, he has been a longtime booster for the city and for Temple University. Until recently, I have to say he was a hometown hero, from his comedy albums to his role as Dr. Huxtable in the very popular Bill Cosby Show. WHYY is debuting a podcast today. It's called Cosby Unraveled, about his Philadelphia roots, his rise to fame, and how these allegations are tarnishing his image. You can download that podcast, whyy.org/Cosby Unraveled. Here's a clip from the podcast, and this is Philadelphia-born jazz musician Christian McBride talking about what Cosby meant to him.
Growing up in Philadelphia, particularly in the mid, late 70s and through the 80s, he was as important to young Philadelphians as, say, like Babe Ruth was to baseball.
Well, joining us is WHYY's Annette John Hall. She is the host of this podcast, also reporter for WHYY's Keystone Crossroads. And Annette, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me, Marty.
You're
great
well.
To be here.
What does Cosby mean to this city? And there's so many Cosbys now. In this day in May 2017.
Yeah. Well, certainly he is the hometown boy who made good here. And he has maintained his connections with the city throughout his rise to fame by lending his name, by lending his pocketbook, and by lending his presence. He has done community walks in North Philadelphia. He has participated as the Grand Master in the Penn Relays. He has supported various political campaigns. And so his presence has loomed large here in Philadelphia, and he's very, very proud of where he came from.
Well, and one of the places that he came from, the Richard Allen Housing Project, and I did some math. Bill Cosby was born in the late 30s. So he
1937,
grew up, 1937,
yes.
So he grew up largely in Philadelphia in the 40s and 50s. I was thinking, well, what would it be like to be poor and black in this city?
Yeah.
And clearly he lived that. I mean, this was a time and a place in U.S. history where, even though above the Mason-Dixon line, it had to be tough.
Sure. It had to be tough, but in his world, in the Richard Allen homes. And
that's where he grew up.
That's where he grew up. And just to set the location, it's on 9th and Parrish, maybe about a half mile from Temple University. And, you know, it was a very tight-knit community, mostly African-American, people who were strivers. They were poor, but they were strivers, people who took pride in where they lived, even though it was in the projects. When we went down there and talked to some old-timers who had lived there, they talked about planting flowers in the flower boxes and, you know, neighborhood kids playing and people sitting on their stoops talking. You know, it was a very close-knit life. And even Cosby says in his comedy albums that, you know, he honed his whole foundation for his comedy right there at the Richard Allen Holmes. The cartoon characters that he created, Old Weird Harold and Mushmouth and Fat Albert, were his real friends. Albert Robertson was a real friend. And old timers used to talk about seeing them walk down Marshall Street. And Cos was the funny guy. And Albert would be cracking up at his jokes, you know. And so, you know, it was very, very instrumental to how he grew up and honed his comedy. Yet at the same time, you know, the 40s and 50s in America for a black person wasn't very kind, and it didn't matter where you lived. There were certain doors that were closed to you, and Cosby was very aware of that.
About a minute before our break here, I don't want to get too deep here, but you wonder whether his humor was his way of dealing with, you know, life in America.
I'm sure.
At that time.
I'm absolutely sure that it was, because, you know, comedians always talk about that, you know, how they deal with their life challenges through their humor. And, you know, that's why they're such acute observers, right?
Yeah.
Because they, I mean, I would say that comedians are the smartest and the best therapists there are.
On that note, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Annette John Hall. She's host of this new WHYY podcast. It did debut today, WHYY.org/Cosby Unraveled. She talked to a lot of people that lived in this Richard Allen Holmes. In fact, we'll be hearing from one of them. Also talked with Wilson Good, former mayor of Philadelphia. We'll be hearing from him as well. And we want to hear from you. We want to know what Bill Cosby means to you. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Let me play another clip from Cosby Unraveled, the new podcast here from WHYY. This is former Philadelphia Mayor Wilson Good talking about Bill Cosby.
I grew up in the segregated South, where African Americans were denied basic and fundamental rights. And to see Bill Cosby rise to fame in the 1960s and in the 1970s just made me absolutely proud. The likelihood of seeing a black man on television was as remote as seeing a black man in the White House.
And that was former Philadelphia Mayor Wilson Good, underscoring, Annette, what you were saying earlier about just, first of all, what it was like to live in Philadelphia at this time, but also what Bill Cosby meant to people who grew up in the city and for whom the city has meant so much. You mentioned the fact you wanted to say something.
No, I'm old enough, Marty, to remember when a black person came on TV, like on the Ed Sullivan Show, and it became a phone chain all throughout the neighborhood. Oh, the Supremes are on. Turn it on Channel 5 or whatever. I grew up in California. It was Channel 5. And it was an event. So, you know, the fact that Bill Cosby was starring on I Spy in 1965 at a time where no black people were starring on television, and the fact that he insisted that his character be Harvard educated, that, you know, he was on an equal level, if not a little higher level than Robert Culp, his co-star, said something about, you know, Bill Cosby and how he thought, and it meant the world to black people to see that kind of image on television.
Let me play another clip from Cosby Unraveled, and this is a woman named Mary Jefferson. She's about 72 years old.
We love Mary.
we will hear from Mary, and she lives currently at the Richard Allen Holmes. This is the same housing project that Bill Cosby grew up. She's also a fan of the Bill Cosby Show. Let's give it a listen.
I love the show.
Why?
He was more like a father to the children.
Yeah.
A down-to-earth father, yeah.
When you heard the accusations of all these women...
When I heard that, I called him a dirty bastard. I didn't know all the facts or anything.
Yeah.
But,
what do you think now, though?
It's two sides to every story.
Yeah.
But if it was my daughter and she came to me, I'm going to have to believe her.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to believe her.
I think Mary speaks for a lot of people.
Mary speaks to the complicated sort of feelings we have about Bill Cosby. You know, the people we spoke to, did they feel betrayed? Yes. Did they feel disappointed? Yes. But at the same time, they felt pride that he came from them, that they could claim him as his own. And they expressed a little bit of skepticism about the number of women who had come out when they did, and asked why they waited so long to do it. And a couple even thought that there was some conspiracy theory. They had a conspiracy theory attached to their thinking. And, you know, Marty, it's understandable when you're black and poor, or if you've been oppressed in this country, how you could think that Cosby was set up, how you could think that people were out to get him because of all the good that he did.
Let me play another clip, one more clip from Cosby Unraveled. And this is a jazz musician, also Philadelphia, born Philadelphia native, Jimmy Heath, talking about Bill Cosby.
My reaction is then and now. I don't believe it. I do not believe it. Everybody wanted to get cars for money.
Annette, underscoring what you just said.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, on the flip side of that, we talked to Penn professor, Salmanisha Tillett, who herself had been a victim of sexual abuse, who really kind of breaks it down about why women don't come forward immediately. You know, trauma is hard to process. And the allegations against Bill Cosby say that he not only sexually assaulted women, he drugged them. If true, that is a lot of trauma to process. And so Professor Tillett kind of breaks it down and explains why women take so long. And there's power in numbers, right? So when one comes forward, it creates this domino effect.
And as our previous guest talked about, this deposition that went public where he talks about giving quaaludes to women, even beyond the woman whose case this is involved in, but giving quaaludes to women in order to have sex with them.
Right.
Just to sort of underscore what you just said.
And if those allegations are true, if a woman was drugged, she may not even remember the alleged attack itself until other women come forward. So it's a very, very complicated thing.
Indeed. Well, let me get a couple of callers in, and then I do want to play a clip from what has been called the pound cake speech. We'll get to that, but let me get a couple of callers. I got some comments as well. This is Kate from Morristown joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
When you're famous, you have privilege and power. President Obama made a personal choice to be above criticism. President Clinton and President Trump said, when you're famous, you can do anything because you're famous. They made the choice. People who betray their privileged position do not deserve our compassion. They have behaved like jerks, and they deserve to pay the price for their actions.
All right, fair enough. I mean, Kate, she's saying people have a choice. There's absolutely no question about it.
Right. People do have a choice. But a lot of the people that we talked to said that while what Cosby did, if true, were heinous acts, and that he should pay the price. They also say that all of his good works cannot be erased. He gave $20 million, Marty, to Spelman College, which is a historically black college in Atlanta, for a women's college. That was, at the time that he and his wife gave it in 1998, was the largest single gift ever given to an HBCU in history. Now, Spelman, after the charges became public, Spelman College gave back the remainder of that money, which was a really hard decision for them to make. But they being a women's college, felt compelled to do that. So, but that's just an example of the things that he has done. And it's very, very difficult to, while maybe you can't reconcile, you know, on the one hand, everything he's done with these allegations, you can't erase it either. It's just a very, very difficult thing to weigh.
No question.
For a lot of people.
Sure. And I think it should be said that as far as this courtroom in Norristown, he is innocent.
That's right.
We are innocent until we are proven guilty. Court of public opinion is something altogether different from that. Let me get Kitty from Philadelphia to join us, and then I do want to play one more clip from the speech that he gave at the NAACP. First, Kitty, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am a professional investigator in Philadelphia, and I'm in this business because I believe in our criminal justice system. It is bothering me tremendously that people have made decisions without evidence. I cannot tell you what I know or think because I don't have all of the evidence, and I wonder when people will stop judging and prejudging. If the man is guilty, he will be punished. If he is not guilty, we have excoriated him and we have convicted and executed him already. There is a balance, and I hope people remember that there are more than two sides to every story. Thank you.
Oh, Kitty, I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
And that, thanks for that call, Kitty, because it's exactly what we try to lay out in the podcast, that human nature is very messy and complicated, and there's a huge gray area. And so, you know, we're not trying to convince people to be for or against Bill Cosby. We just are trying to lay out the story in a very Philadelphia way.
And we know exactly what that is. Enough
and
said.
You know, Philadelphians have opinions.
Yes,
we try to lay it out in a Philadelphia way and then let people decide.
Well, let me play this this speech. And again, this goes back, more than a decade. It was delivered May 2004 at a NAACP award ceremony. It was in Washington, D.C. to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. And here is just a tiny portion of what Bill Cosby said at that event.
We've got to take the neighborhood back. We've got to go in there. It's right around the corner. It's standing on the corner. It can't speak English. It doesn't want to speak English. I can't even talk the way these people talk. Why you ain't where you is? Go wild there. I don't know who these people are. And I blamed the kid until I heard the mother talk. And then I heard the father talk. This is all in the house.
So much there, to pick up on. First of all, there is laughter in the audience.
Yes.
It sort of takes us full circle to Hannibal Buress, who was basically saying in 2014, don't tell me how to live my life.
Right, right.
Or whether I should pull up my pants or not, look at you.
Right. You know, during that time, we noticed that there was a shift in how Cosby decided to become a public figure. While he was still doing some stand-up here and there, he decided that he wanted to become, as one judge referred to it and as everybody's calling it now, a public moralist. And he decided that he wanted to admonish and chastise poor black people about how they dressed, how they talked, how they named their children, in names that nobody can pronounce, he said. He called them the lower economics, you know, how they chose to live their lives.
Well, even in this clip, he says it,
yes.
As if referring to people as things.
As things and not people. And, I mean, while people laughed in that audience, he was preaching to the NAACP crowd, who is this, for the most part, this, you know, high income kind of $100 a plate crowd. But if you really listen to parts of that speech carefully, there was nervous laughter in the audience when he was talking about people like that. And so a lot of people took exception to that. And I would say, you know, younger people were like, who is this? We don't even remember the Cosby Show. Who is this cat trying to tell us what to do and how to wear our pants? I mean, and you know, I mean, my son is college educated. He wears his pants slung low. You know, and so it's just a fashion statement. And so then a lot of critique was done about Bill Cosby at that time, and one of them was Michael Eric Dyson, who's
sure.
the scholar and the author,
sure.
who wrote a whole book about it.
In fact, we had him on the show talking
yeah,
about it.
Yeah,
yeah, no, go ahead,
yeah.
go ahead.
And so you know, and people were wondering. How did he become so mean? You know, how did he become so cranky? And people have lots of theories for that. But I think it's just that Bill Cosby was from the school of, I did all this for you. I gave millions to black causes. You know, I was an example of black excellence. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. And now look at how you're acting.
Well, and it just underscores when there is a celebrity, a public person, they have a public life or a public persona, they have private lives. I mean, there's so many people that we could put on that list of people who have not just disappointed us, but profoundly, you know, affected the worlds that we live in.
You know, absolutely. And a lot of women that we came across talked about that hypocrisy, talked about how, you know, this man is talking about people living moral lives, yet at the same time, these allegations are lingering in the background that he drugged mm-hmm. and sexually assaulted all of these women over a period of over 50 years, almost 50 years. And so then how can you be that person?
We're almost out of time here, but I'm getting flashbacks to the O.J. Simpson trial, which was also about race and
yes.
sex and gender
yes.
and, you know, all these things that are still with us.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it just adds to the complication, especially with this jury selection. There are no African Americans on this jury yet.
I think there's one.
One? Oh,
one,
I'm,
one.
My mistake. Yeah, there is one. There is one. And so that is going to put a whole new layer of race into this whole jury thing. So, I mean, you know, it will be interesting to see. My hope is that justice is just done, and justice for the alleged victims, justice for Cosby, if there's justice to be served for him. And so we can all just be more comfortable in this.
Well, we will find out. Annette John Hall, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks,
on
Marty.
Radio Times, reporter at WHYY for Keystone Crossroads, and she's the host of this new podcast. It just downloaded today, following the Cosby trial. It's called Cosby Unraveled. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.